Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Colin Powell has wound up his latest attempt to unroll the roadmap to peace in the Middle East. The message from the U.S. Secretary of State is, start small. Work on the areas where progress can be made. But just as Powell was concluding his trip to the region, suicide bombers in Saudi Arabia punctuated his visit with a deadly reminder. At last count, over 20 people, seven of them American, were killed when terrorists set off truck bombs at a residential compound in the Saudi capital of Riyadh. The attack illustrates just how enormously complicated the politics of the entire region can be, and how both anger and expectations of American involvement are key to what comes next. So, Connection listeners, will the bombs in Saudi Arabia do anything to interfere with the U.S. push for peace in the Middle East? And is the new Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas and Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon prepare to meet for the first time this weekend? Can the roadmap still lead to peace? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me today is Rami Khoury. He's the executive editor of the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon, an internationally syndicated columnist, normally at the distant end of a telephone line and sitting here in the studio in Boston. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
Rami, we had originally thought that we'd be talking specifically about the roadmap to peace, and then there were the bombs in Saudi Arabia, and we were trying to figure out which of the two we should address. And in fact, you're writing that they're very much connected and ought to be talked about at the same time. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that neither these kinds of bombs nor the attempt to push forward a peace process based on gradual mutual concessions, neither of these things is new. We've lived with these things for probably the last decade, and neither of them have succeeded. But they are part of a wider dynamic, a kind of an integrated process in the region that includes anger by many people in the Middle East and the Arab world against their own governments, their own regimes, dissatisfaction with what is happening in Israel and Palestine, anger at the...
Let me stop you for a minute, because if what we have are some Saudi extremists setting off bombs in their own country to force reform or change in Saudi Arabia, why is that necessarily a part of whatever is complicating the peace process between the Palestinians and the Israelis?
Because I think if you go back over the last, say, 15, 20 years, when really we had the beginning of serious terror incidents in the Arab world, I think you can trace a linear process by which ordinary people become angry, become humiliated, become disenchanted, become hopeless, become dehumanized, and then they become terrorists. And I think that process includes these different components. They become terrorists because of factors in several different arenas in their lives. And I think the important thing is not to make the mistake of looking at people, neither in the Arab world, nor in Israel, nor anywhere else, in a one-dimensional way. These are not people who only hate America or are angry at Israel or dislike their own governments. All of these things pertain at the same time. And I think this is one of the great unmet challenges of our moment now, that I think there's been insufficient assessment by people in the Arab world and by people in the U.S. and abroad to work together to really unravel the road that a person travels to become a terrorist. My sense, living in the Middle East and mixing with people all over the Middle East and seeing how ordinary people behave and feel, my sense is that you really must look at all of these factors together.
Well, you were saying to our producer, Christine, on the telephone yesterday that having just got off the plane in New York, that you watch the American television news and you see a story about Iraq. Stop. You see a story about terrorism. Stop. You see a story about the roadmap. And that something's lost in this country because the connections aren't made between these stories.
Right. I think there is a simplistic, unidimensional, stereotypical, and in some cases racist, and in some cases racist attitude towards understanding why people are violent in the Middle East. If people applied the same analysis to, say, African Americans in this country, that they applied to Muslims and Arabs in the Middle East, they'd be taken to court. They'd be sued for infringing fairness doctrines and infringing moral standards and libel and whatever. But the way that the mass media, generally speaking, in the U.S., with some exceptions, with NPR being one of the main ones in terms of fairness and balance and in-depth coverage, but broadly the American media, I think, has done a huge disservice to the American people in pigeonholing these issues and just looking at a bomb in Saudi Arabia and something in Israel and Palestine and something within a domestic Arab context. The reality is that these things are all linked together, and they form a cycle which is a pretty devastating one.
Let's, if we can, go to Saudi Arabia. Suleiman Al-Hatlan is joining us now. He's a fellow at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard, also a columnist for Al-Watan newspaper in Saudi Arabia, joining us from Riyadh. Suleiman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I'm interested in the latest news from Riyadh. Do we have, for example, any idea who was it or who set the truck bombs off?
I believe this is a very early stage to come up with a confirmed news about who is really behind it. I mean, we all talk about Al-Qaeda. Very much possible that Al-Qaeda is behind it. Some hours ago, that Prince Naif, who is the interior minister of Saudi Arabia, just confirmed the discovery of two new fundamentalist organizations in Saudi Arabia. One is called Al-Muwahhidun, and the other one is called Al-Mujahidun. Rumors and speculations are that they are somehow linked to Al-Qaeda.
And the way that the bombs are being regarded in Saudi Arabia, because they were aimed at a compound where a number of Westerners lived, are people saying, oh, well, that's just, you know, something that was targeted at people from away, or are people looking at it also very seriously as an attack against the Saudi government?
Well, the majority of people I talk to today look at it as an attack against Saudi Arabia and Saudi people as well. I mean, if Al-Qaeda has won any credit in Saudi Arabia before Monday or last Monday, I think they lost all credits. People now understand that terrorism does not distinguish between Americans or Arabs or Muslims or non-Muslims. I mean, seven Saudis were killed in Monday's attack.
All right, so something for both you and Rami. One of the obvious effects of this is coming as it did on the tail end of Powell's visit. It stops all conversation about the roadmap, and it gets people talking about Al-Qaeda again. Was that, do you think, Suleiman, do you think that was the intention?
Perhaps there was a kind of coordination to, in terms of the timing. I mean, obviously, there was a kind of sophistication to organize it just hours before the arrival of the Colin Powell visit to Saudi Arabia. Was that related to the roadmap? I pretty much doubt it. Perhaps there was an intention to embarrass the Saudi establishment in a such a highly visit like Colin Powell's visit.
Yeah, I would argue that also that it's probably linked in part to what happened in Iraq in the last 2 months. I don't know how quickly groups like this can organize these sort of attacks, whether they have to plan weeks ahead or they can just mobilize within a couple of hours. But I think what you're seeing is an act that is part of, again, of a process that's been going on for about 12 years or so with these bombings against American and indigenous Arab and Saudi and other targets in the Gulf. So I think we should not not link it too much with a specific visit by a specific official, but see it much more as a longer-term trend.
Do you, Suleiman, earlier I was talking with Rami just about the way that terrorism is now used as a political tool in the Middle East, and I'm wondering from your perspective whether or not the war in Iraq or the latest 3 years of the Intifada between the Palestinians and the Israelis, this has made, you know, the use of truck bombs, the use of terrorism, a more acceptable political weapon.
We could argue about this. I mean, the fact that there is a few doors to express political ideas in the Arab world eases the way for terrorists to express their political disagreements by terrorism. People believe that this is the only way to express your political disagreements. Of course, by the majority of people's standard, this is immoral, this is illegal. But I should remind you, since Rami mentioned the war in Iraq, the fact that the Arab world watched a totally different war in Iraq than the one people in the U.S. watch. I mean, the media in the Arab world focused very, very much on the other face of the war that the Americans, or most of Americans, did not see, which is the civilians, victims in Baghdad. And to my surprise, I just arrived 2 days ago to Saudi Arabia. Everybody in Saudi Arabia is still talking about the magnitude of the victims or the war in Iraq. It is still the talk of town in Riyadh.
And despite it's not just, I would say, not just the bombing that went on during the war, but every day Iraqis are being killed either by leftover cluster bombs and things from the American-British bombing and also from the chaos that is still reigning in Iraq. So this generates tremendous reactions among ordinary Arab people, a few of whom go off and decide to do some terror bombings.
One of the things
that... if I can add a point, Dick.
Go ahead.
Yeah, with all due respect to all the arguments about the political culture in the Middle East and the war in Iraq and the peace process, etc., I think we in the Arab world have to face the reality that we have a problem of Islamic fundamentalism, and we, the Arabs and Muslims, must face the reality and acknowledge the fact that we have a problem and deal with it. I mean, we all talk about reforms in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in many Arab countries, but all we do is talking about reform. We have not engaged in real process of reforming. So my point is, I don't think it is healthy for our people to just blame, you know, the West or the United States for our own problems, domestic problems, religious fundamentalist problems. I think what happened in Riyadh Monday night, I mean, some people here trying to name it, they want to say this is the 9/11 of Saudi Arabia, with understanding the huge difference in the magnitude of 9/11 in New York and the so-called 9/11 of Saudi Arabia. But there is somehow a positive dialogue among Saudis yesterday and today. They are talking about the fact that we have a face, we have to face a real problem of extremism, and I think this is the healthiest way to handle these issues of terrorism.
Suleiman, I want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Suleiman Al-Khatlan is a fellow at the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University, a columnist for Al-Watan newspaper in Saudi Arabia. He was talking to us from Riyadh. Just a couple of seconds before we go to a break, but Rami, that's exactly what you've been writing about, that this is a very interesting, precarious moment now, with the U.S. having made this offer of democracy in Iraq and whether or not that can be pursued and taken into the Middle East.
Yes, I think we have to be careful about the nature and sincerity of the American offer. Most people in the Middle East are skeptical about it, but it is true that there are strong movements within the Middle East and have been for decades of people trying to reform their societies, get better governance, get more consent of the governed, democracy, accountability, all of these things. But they've made no progress. One reason is because the U.S. and the West have supported autocratic regimes. And the chickens have come home to roost. This is the moment of reckoning now. And hopefully we will move, all of us, Americans, Arabs, Christians, Muslims, Jews, all together towards real reform, but throughout the region.
Connection listeners, more on the roadmap and the options ahead when we come back after the break. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBU.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about the just concluded tour of Secretary of State Colin Powell and his first attempt to talk about peace, the roadmap to peace, at least in the Middle East, and the way that was concluded with the bomb in Saudi Arabia. With me in the studio, Rami Khoury. He's executive editor of the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, also an internationally syndicated political columnist. We're joined now on the line from Tel Aviv. Is it Tel Aviv?
Where? Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, sorry. Hemi Shalev is joining us from Jerusalem. He's a political commentator for the Israeli newspaper Ma'arif and Israel correspondent for the Jewish weekly Forward, based in New York. Hemi, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hello.
You've had a chance to listen to a little bit of the conversation about the implications of the bomb in Saudi Arabia on the roadmap for peace. And before we turn directly to the map, I wanted to hear your thoughts on that, whether or not it can have a significant effect.
Well, I'm not sure that the roadmap was in any great shape before the bombing took place, so I'm not sure that there will be such a significant impact. I think if we look at it from our particular Israeli point of view, the Prime Minister Sharon is going to Washington on Sunday and will be meeting next week with President Bush. And from the Israeli perspective, the bombing sort of put things back in their proper place, and Sharon and Bush will be able to agree between them that the fight against terrorism is of paramount importance. And probably, in this context, perhaps more important than the roadmap.
Are you saying politically, Hemi, that the bomb in Saudi Arabia puts the issue of terror sort of in exactly the same place for the President of the United States as it is for the Prime Minister of Israel?
I think so. I think that was one of the results of 9/11, one of the results of the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. There's a lot of agreement between the two leaders on their view of the world. They have differences when they get to the nuts and bolts of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but generally speaking, I think both of them view the world in terms of black and white, so to speak, and such a bombing, I think, reinforces their ideological agreement.
So does that mean you agree with Rami that every event like this in the region needs to be put into the same stew pot?
Well, I don't know. I think there are particulars and there are generalities. I think I would agree with Rami from the other way around, although he might object to this, that there is definitely, from the point of view of both Israel and the United States, there is a problem with Islamic terrorism as a whole, no matter what its particular motivations are. And here in Israel, we tend to view, rightly or wrongly, we tend to view Palestinian terrorism not only as being directed against us, but also as being part of the war of Islamic fundamentalism against the United States. And it is no wonder that frequently Prime Minister Sharon tends to equate Yasser Arafat with bin Laden, not only because it makes a good selling point in the United States, but also because it represents his view on the way things really are.
Yeah, I think I would take Hemi's invitation to disagree with him on that because I think there is a fundamental difference in how people in the whole world virtually view terror in the Middle East, and the American president and the Israeli prime minister have a certain perspective, but this is a perspective that is not shared by about 90% of the world. I think the world generally sees terror as a consequence of recent history. Terror is not an ideology like communism or a political party. People became terrorists because things happened in the last 20, 30 years. Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, Hamas, these groups didn't exist before the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon and the West Bank. And they now do exist, and they are involved in terror. So there is a need to fight terror everywhere in the world. There's no doubt about that. And I would agree with Hemi and every other Israeli and American and everybody in the Arab world. We must fight terror, but we must also accurately know why terror happens, how it started, what are the reasons for it, and therefore how to fight it. And I would give the Northern Ireland example as the best one. There's very little terror in Northern Ireland now because the American and British and Irish and other governments work together to address the root causes, solve it politically, fairly for everybody, and the terror has stopped. And I think we need to understand whether we call it Islamic terror or Arab terror or Middle Eastern terror or even as the Zionists used terror in the 1940s against the British. Everybody has used terror, but they stop using it when the reasons for it stop. And I think this is a much more difficult way to address the issue, but it's the only successful way in the end.
Hemi.
I don't disagree with that, but I think we are talking here about a situation of the chicken and the egg. The Israeli view, I think the American view as well, is that terrorism must stop before the political matters are addressed. While there is a contrary view currently being presented by the Palestinian side, that at worst, the two should be concurrent, and at best, a political solution should precede the fight against terrorism. And this sort of conflicting view has brought us to the dead end that we are at right now. What Secretary Powell heard from Prime Minister Sharon is that until the Palestinians start fighting terrorism, Israel won't move an inch. And what he heard from the Palestinians is that until Israel begins making political concessions, they are incapable of fighting terrorism.
Right, that's what the roadmap was supposed to try to bridge that gap, to try to get the Israelis pulling out and stopping settlements and the Palestinians controlling the terrorists in Palestine and people fighting Israel through military resistance. Those were supposed to be done at the same time, but it doesn't seem to be moving very quickly.
Okay, but one thing that you have both written is that let's not get our hopes up about this roadmap. Hemia, I read an editorial piece by you saying that, Rami, you've been saying that for some time. But we might as well start with a slightly more positive perspective. We have the Prime Minister Sharon meeting with the Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas on Saturday night, unless something happens to interrupt that meeting. And Hemi, that's the first time that there will have been a meeting like that in 3 years. That has to count for something at this point, doesn't it?
Well, either it will or it won't. We have to wait and see what the outcome will be of the meeting, and I don't mean just in terms of what they will agree or disagree on, but what kind of atmosphere will emerge from the meeting, even from a press conference, if they'll have one after the meeting. I think that, yes, if they have, even if they're just smiling after the meeting, even if they claim to have agreed on anything, it might change the atmosphere here, and of course that is a precondition to any movement. But as we look at their positions going into the meeting, it's very hard to find room for optimism that beyond the very fact that they're meeting, there will be any real breakthrough. And also there are cynics in Israel, I must say, who claim that the only reason that the meeting is taking place when it is because it serves as a good send-off for Sharon before his meeting with Bush on Tuesday to show that he is, after all, doing his best to try to calm things down.
Yeah, I would share the hope that this meeting could be the beginning of a process that sees some achievements in terms of Israeli-Palestinian peace, but I really doubt it. And I think the difficulty is that we know that the Israelis and the Palestinians cannot on their own now move forward and make a negotiated peace. There must be some external involvement, whether it's the U.S. or the Quartet or whatever it is. I think there's been a lot of romanticism in terms of people looking at the Israelis and the Palestinians sitting together, having meetings. These things simply will not get us anywhere. We need much more drastic, significant, forceful movement, and external involvement or even pressure on both sides is needed.
All right, Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, a chance to look at the moment after Secretary of State Colin Powell's travels through the Middle East and the options or the opportunities presented by the roadmap for peace, at least the meeting coming up on Saturday between the two prime ministers, a meeting scheduled for next Tuesday between the President of the United States and Israel's prime minister. Is this leading anywhere new? Does this change the stalemate that has been so much a part of the problem there? 1-800-423-8255. And Rami, a number of times you've been writing about this and making the point that the U.S. has been losing credibility or whatever chance it has to act as the broker here because of a position which is seen to be so pro Israel. Does that mean that Powell operates on a different basis when he travels to the Middle East now, or can the U.S. reclaim some of that
negotiation sort of center ground?
Well, I think the U.S. certainly can regain both credibility as a negotiator and trust as a partner for both sides. This is not about personalities, Powell or Rumsfeld or Kissinger. Or, you know, we've been through these people for the last 40 years. It's about policies and national interests. The United States is the only party that can play this role. It's the only party that Israel trusts. Therefore, the ground rules are pretty clear. It is the only party that can move the process forward by pressure or cajoling or whatever. And it has been partial to Israel. There's no doubt about it. Still, the Palestinians have no choice. They have to go along with it. There's a massive attempt that has been made in the last 10 to 11 years to negotiate a peace, and it hasn't worked. And from the Arab-Palestinian side, we feel that the main reason it hasn't worked is that what Sharon said yesterday, which is Israel wants to keep building settlements and have peace, and it just doesn't work. You can't colonize somebody's territory and ask them to sign a peace treaty with you. So the Israeli people really have to make a choice, and the majority of Israelis have said clearly in public opinion polls, and they've clearly said they're willing to negotiate peace, live with the Palestinians, live with the Palestinian state, and even get out of most of the settlements. And so have the majority of Palestinians said they would be willing to coexist in peace with Israelis. What we haven't found is how do we get that majority on both sides mobilized. And this is what the Americans have failed to do.
Hemi, can I just ask you about what I read in my morning paper about Israel's prime minister asked about dismantling settlements or outposts. Mr. Sharon told the Jerusalem Post, quote, "It's not something today that anyone's dealing with. In my mind, this is not an issue on the horizon right now." And then later, the reporter writes that an advisor to Mr. Sharon played down those remarks as domestic politics, saying the prime minister was simply trying to shore up support on the right. What's the truth there? Is that his position, or is he using that position to play a little bit of local politics before he meets with Bush?
It's very difficult for me, in fact, for any Israeli, to give you a definitive answer on where the prime minister is headed, what his intentions are, what he really intends to do should the Palestinians meet his first precondition, which is combating terror. He, especially in the past few months, has made conflicting statements about the settlement. Sometimes he talks about the painful concessions that Israel will have to make, and sometimes he negates those very concessions that he was talking about. Mr. Sharon has found it useful to keep his cards very, very close to his chest. Not even his close advisors or ministers know exactly what his intentions are. And I think that we won't know the answer unless the Palestinian side takes steps that will force him to show some of his cards. There is no doubt that the prime minister is deeply attached to the settlements. He was, after all, the father of many of the current settlements in the territories. On the other hand, he is also very much aware and has high regard for his relations with the United States. I think the prime minister knows that the settlements issue, of all the issue, is the one potential mine in his meetings with Bush and with the administration. And so, to make a short answer after this long answer, I think he is trying to play down the significance of the issue for internal reasons. But his advisors know that if there is anything that could make his meeting with Bush on Tuesday go wrong, it is the settlements issue.
But what holds Sharon's feet to the fire here? Is it the prospect of meeting with a more moderate face of Palestinian leadership in Mahmoud Abbas? Is that what will force him to show some of those cards that he's holding so close? Because it doesn't appear to be heat from the White House that's going to change anything.
No, it doesn't seem to be heat from the White House. The only thing, and it doesn't matter what your views on whether the Palestinians should or should not start combating terrorism right away, the only thing that will force his hand, indeed, will also cause a sea change in Israeli public opinion, is if Israelis see Palestinian security officials fighting Hamas and Islamic Jihad groups. I think that is the only thing that can change public opinion around. Because what Rami said before is true about the theoretical positions of the Israeli public. The Israeli public theoretically supports many of the aspects of the roadmap, for example, but it has a deep mistrust of the Palestinians, and it has to, after 2 years of terror, I think Israelis need to be convinced that there is a change on the Palestinian side. And if they're not convinced of that, I don't see anything that will force Sharon to show his hand.
And that's why this roadmap has been proposed, to try to bridge these gaps and to get the Palestinians working on security and to get the Israelis working on decolonization and to get some of these settlements stopped and the occupation pulled back. I'm a little bit worried about the political fragility of the new Palestinian prime minister, because the problem with the with Abu Mazen and the people with him is that they are presented in Israel and the U.S. especially as great hope, and these are people who are going to bring reform and stop the violence, etc., etc. While in Palestinian society, they're viewed very differently. They're viewed as people who are handpicked by Israel in the United States. They are seen as people who
are... Is that accurate, though?
Well, it's, I think, quite accurate. I mean, they were very much pushed by Israel in the United States as part of the first regime change that took place in the Middle East under American pressure to try to sideline Arafat. They're seen by many Palestinians to be implicated in a modern, recent tradition of corruption and exploiting your position for personal family wealth. They don't have a pristine, clean reputation.
Well, I mean, neither does Arafat.
So. No, of course not. But to present this new leadership as a great hope for reform, etc., is simplistic at best, and I think romantic at worst. And it's not.
If it leads to an end to the violence, does any of that matter?
Well, this is what the hope. I mean, the Palestinians, despite all of these problems with Israeli intransigence, not sure what the Americans are going to do, lack of credibility of the leadership of the Palestinians in Palestine, despite all this, the Palestinians are saying, let's do the roadmap. They want to call the bluff of the Americans and the Israelis. If it is a bluff, they want to find out, is this serious? Is this a serious opening to peace? And if it is, they want to move towards a negotiated peace. So despite all these pressures, the Palestinians are want to implement the roadmap. If then the Israelis start withdrawing and easing some of their pressures on the Palestinians and freezing the settlements, if Abu Mazen can show these political gains through peaceful negotiations to his people, then he will be in a better position to crack down militarily on some of the groups that are involved in terror, like Hamas and others, and do resistance through political negotiations rather than through military violence. But there's a very slim chance. I mean, I hope it happens. I hope Elijah comes out and sits with Sharon and Abu Mazen and their meeting and pushes them towards peace, but it's very, very slim chance.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. What hopes do you hold for this particular roadmap at this time, leading to an end of violence and some form of Middle East peace? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Bildner Charitable Public.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And it's so often said that solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the one solution that will lead to the end of so many other conflicts in the Middle East. So, Connection listeners, how important is the roadmap that's being discussed right now in a couple of important meetings that are coming up this weekend and next Tuesday? 1-800-423-8255 brings you into the conversation. Let's start in Louisville, Kentucky. Chip's on the line. Hi, Chip.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me on the show. I have several questions, and I'm not sure quite where to start, but I think that...
Pick your best question, just in case I cut you off, okay?
I understand. It's a complicated issue,
sure,
but
is.
Given everything that goes on in the world, I mean, when you look at the Kurds' situation vis-a-vis the Turks and the Syrians and the Iranians and the Iraqis, you know, what's so different about the Palestinian situation that it commands center stage all the time? And, you know, I mean, there was a phenomenal offer on the table in Oslo 94, and they turned up their nose at it. And I think it's because Arafat's own people wouldn't let him take that offer. I think it boils down to the fact that they don't want to see Israel exist in the first place. And that's the ultimate objective. I mean, is to eliminate the state of Israel.
Well, that there is, Chip, a huge group of people who would say yes, that's exactly why we want to make sure there's never Middle East peace, because that's a recognition of Israel. Rami, does that constituency grow, or is that constituency about the same size? What can you
tell us? I think there's been a huge change in the Arab world in the last 15 or so years. Now you have a massive majority in the Arab world, official states, governments, people, civil society, all on the record saying they are ready to negotiate a permanent peace between an Israeli state and a Palestinian state. So what Chip is saying may have been true about 20 years ago.
But there's still lots of...
There's some people.
Hamas and the people who are setting off the suicide bombs.
These are a minority group in the Arab world, and their position is a position that they're free to hold. But if the majority wants to negotiate a peace and the Palestinian refugee problem is solved fairly and according to international law and UN resolutions, and Israel exists as a Jewish majority state and security, and the Palestinians have a state, then these minority groups in the Arab world simply will have to go along with the majority will. And this is the real challenge for the Palestinians, to affirm that majority will to coexist in peace.
Have you got a simple answer to Chip's first question about why it is that this one conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis remains always at center stage when there are so many other struggles for peoples and lands going on around
the
world?
Yeah, I think quickly I would say there's several reasons. One is clearly the linkage with the modern history of the Jewish people. I mean, what the Jews suffered, the genocide, the Holocaust, was seen as such a huge moral crime and terrible crime that it remains a compelling issue to have the safety of the Jewish state. Also, the Palestinians are still struggling. They're not going away. They're fighting and they're working for their national rights. And the third reason I would say is that many people in the Arab world see the Israeli-Palestinian conflict within the longer lens of Western colonial interference in the Middle East. So that's why so many other Arabs respond so emotionally and powerfully to the suffering of the Palestinians. They don't see it as a foreign issue. They see it as part of their own degradation. Those are the three main reasons, I think.
All right, Chip, I hope that gets you somewhere towards a better understanding. 1-800-423-8255. Now to Concord, Massachusetts, and John's joining us. Hi, John.
Hi. I'm wondering if President Bush can get tough with Sharon because of Israel's congressional supporters and other lobbying groups and Karl Rove's religious right. I don't see him ever getting tough with Sharon on the settlements.
You mean even if he wanted to? There's too much pressure on him not to?
Yeah, especially with, of course, the election coming next year and all that. So I'm just wondering if there's any hope that he will get tough on settlements with Sharon.
Hemi Shalev, can you help us with that?
Well, the question is, does President Bush want to get tough with Sharon on anything?
Does he want to? And if he does, could he do anything about it? Right?
Well, but if he doesn't want to, then the question of whether he can or not is not important.
Right.
And all indications, except for if we look at the past 2 years since Sharon came to power, there have been some spats between the two. But generally speaking, President Bush has not seemed like he is eager start pressuring Sharon. And again, I think we get back to the earlier issue that we were talking about, the chicken and the egg. As long as the president accepts the prime minister's view that the Palestinians have not done anything against terrorism, I don't think that he will have the motivation to pressure Sharon. The United States, including the president, are opposed to settlements, but as long as the situation continues, I don't see the Americans bringing full pressure to bear on Sharon. As to the internal American political situation, these are well-known facts that during an election year, politicians all over the world and the president as well has to take into account the various political groups in America. Some people view that quite dimly. It can also be seen as part of the working democracy. There is no doubt that as we enter the presidential election year, the chances of the president seeking a confrontation with Sharon are diminishing every day.
It's remarkable, though, when you look back, Rami Khoury, at the number of instances when any honest effort to find peace in the Middle East has fallen captive to the U.S. political timetable.
Yeah.
Whether we're talking about Clinton in his last months of office, or there are the window's very small.
Well, it is small, and I think there's two conclusions that I draw from this. One, unfortunately, is that the level of fighting and suffering and dying that is going on in the Arab-Israeli conflict, especially between Palestinians and Israelis, is a level that is manageable for the world. The world can live with this conflict in its present configuration. And, of course, Israelis and Palestinians are suffering, so are other people, but it's not something that the world must resolve. That's
but
why
isn't it something that Israelis and Palestinians also choose to live with? If it's three deaths here and five deaths there, it's sort of like, well, that's a manageable level of
Well, they're both fighting what they see as an existential battle for their survival as a people and as a nation, as a community. So this is a struggle that will go on until they can resolve it politically. The other conclusion I draw is that what we're seeing is one of the deficiencies of American democracy, which is that you can get a special interest group in a way hijacking the political process. You see it now with the neocons, the neoconservatives in the U.S. and some of the agenda that they're imposing on the country. And this is one of the deficiencies of a democracy, is that well-organized lobbies that are really professional and active and can wield political power or electoral power can carry out a policy that may be not in the best interest of the whole country.
All right, John, thanks for that call. 1-800-423-8255. Now to Varoma, Wisconsin, and Bob's on the line. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Yes, I certainly agree with your contextual analysis, and I'd like to key in on a couple of comments. You said that in the Arab world, that they watched the horror of that in terms of what was happening to the civilian population and all the destruction. And then you also said that the U.S.
You're talking about the war in Iraq, right?
Right.
Bob? Yeah, okay.
And then you also said that the U.S. could only be the honest broker in the Mideast. And I guess, you know, given all these events and the Arabs looking at possibly some of our acts as being colonial acts, how can we be the honest broker? And then given all that, I just don't understand what was the real reason for the Iraq war in the midst of all this. I mean, it just seems very difficult to, I mean, the State Department certainly must appreciate the contextual analysis. Mm-hmm. So given that, could you enlighten me on that?
Let me start with Hemi Shalev on that, because it's something I know Rami has addressed, and Rami, I'll ask you to speak about it, but how the war in Iraq really has changed the standing of the United States in its ability to operate in any kind of independent way in the Middle East or unattached way. Do you know what I mean?
I agree with what Rami said before. I don't think the question is whether the United States can be an honest broker. The plain fact is that the United States is the only broker around, honest or dishonest. That's what we have, and that's what we have to work with. I think the war in Iraq strengthened both facets of the American involvement. On the one hand, it was a strong arm American tactics, which were viewed by many in the Arab world as being anti-Arab, perhaps even anti-Muslim. On the other hand, the United States now has achieved its aim. It is there. It is has a sizable force on the ground. And its presence in the area has gotten even larger than it was before. So that the only way to get anything done is through the United States. That's quite obvious.
Even though, Rami, there are, what, 250,000 troops now in the Middle East? That take on the United States as broker, honest or otherwise, people will still have to, on both sides, say, okay.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, the United States is probably in a better position now to be a honest broker if it wants to be. It has more leverage with Israel because it has removed the threat from Iraq that the Israelis saw as a really huge long-term strategic threat. It clearly has put pressure on Syria and Iran and other people that the Israelis are worried about. So the United States can now turn to Israel and say, look, guys, this we've secured the neighborhood, and let's sit down and make a reasonable and legitimate peace. In the Arab world, the majority of people, I think, are critical of the U.S. and what it has done in Iraq, but they're still willing to go along with it. And the United States gets a lot of criticism in the Arab world for its policies, not for its values or its genes or its history, but for its policies. If those policies become more fair and more even-handed and more legal, or legitimate, you will find a lot of Arabs working very happily with the United States. So we can see the United States build on this moment of opportunity and develop much more credibility and even-handedness in the Middle East.
And Hemi, can the United States do that? Can the United States be moved to, as what Rami's describing, as a more equitable position without being seen by Israelis as abandoning them?
Well, it's a very difficult question to answer. First of all, Israelis, I think, are very happy with the fact that the United States seems to be so supportive as it is now. But I will remind you that there were previous administrations, including, say, the last administration, President Clinton's administration, which in Arab eyes was much more even-handed than the Bush administration and was nonetheless considered by the vast majority of Israelis to be very friendly to Israel, and that it had Israel's best interests at heart. So if we look at the positions of the current administration, I think, yes, if the administration would show more involvement, if it from time to time exerted pressure on Israel, I don't think this would undermine the Israeli admiration for the United States. There is a certain point beyond which Israelis would not want the Americans to go, but I think the current administration is quite far away from that point.
And Rami, I wonder if I can close with a line from your last piece in the paper. You wrote, "This week, as I watched Arab television stations in Beirut and Amman, and then American television here, I have cringed before the realization that our mass media, with only some exceptions, largely portray our two cultures as antagonists at war, also in many cases as cultural and religious threats to one another." If we're talking about finding some way where the United States can regain some credibility in the Arab world, does it also have to happen in the media? Is that a key battlefield for that to play out?
I think the media is an important arena, certainly, because it is the main way that people in the United States, the public at large, gets its information about the Middle East. So the media, academia, the business world, the civil society, all of these are elements that have to really step up now and play a role. The governments, the official institutions of the Arab world, of Israel and the United States, have been involved in a monumental failure of the last 20, 30 years, leading to this incredible situation now where we're getting Americans with 300,000 troops and attacking Arab countries, and people in the Arab countries bombing American installations, and Palestinians and Israelis killing each other in the thousands. This is unbelievable, this course that we're on. We've got to get off of this course, and it has been a failure by the governments in this process that I think should now push people in the civil society, the media, and others to come up with a better way to resolve this issue.
Rami Khoury, nice to have you here in the studio.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Rami Khoury is an internationally syndicated political columnist and executive editor of the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon. Hemi Shalev, thanks a lot for your time.
You're welcome.
Hemi is political commentator for the Israeli newspaper Ma'arif. Earlier in the program, we talked with Suleiman Al-Hatlan, columnist for the Al-Watan newspaper in Saudi Arabia. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. Dick Gordon's guest Rami Khoury will participate in a panel discussion on the Middle East at Northeastern University this afternoon at 1 o'clock. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Chobi Hoy Associates, previous winner of the TAB Reader's Choice Award for 4 consecutive years, offering real estate consultation for sales or rentals, 617-739-0067. By the Huntington Theater Company, presenting Springtime for Henry, a classic comedy now through June 15th, 617-266-0800.